A Midsummer Night's Dream. Act 5, Scene 1. Hippolyta. 'Tis strange, my Theseus, that these lovers speak of. Theseus. More strange than true, I never may believe these antique fables, nor these fairy toys. Lovers and madmen have such seething brains, such shaping fantasies that apprehend more than cool reason ever comprehends. The lunatic, the lover, and the poet are of imagination all compact. One sees more devils than vast hell can hold. That is, the madman. The lover, all as frantic, sees Helen's beauty in a brow of Egypt. The poet's eye, in fine frenzy rolling, doth glance from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven, and as imagination bodies forth the forms of things unknown, the poet's pen turns them to shapes and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. Such tricks hath strong imagination that if it would but apprehend some joy, it comprehends some bringer of that joy. Or in the night, imagining some fear, how easy is a bush supposed a bear? Hippolyta. But all the story of the night told over, and all their minds transfigured so together, more witnesseth than fancy's images, and grows to something of great constancy, but howsoever strange and admirable. Okay, the second reading is The Glory of the Lord by Hans Urs von Balthasar. Beauty is the word which shall be our first. Beauty is the last thing which the thinking intellect dares to approach, since only it dances as an uncontained splendor around the double constellation of the true and the good, and their inseparable relation to one another. Beauty is the disinterested one, without which the ancient world refused to understand itself. A word which both imperceptibly and unmistakably has bid farewell to our new world, a world of interests, leaving it to its own avarice and sadness. No longer loved or fostered by religion, beauty is lifted from its face as a mask, and its absence exposes features on that face which threaten to become incomprehensible to man. We no longer dare to believe in beauty, and we make of it a mere appearance in order the more easily to dispose of it. Our situation today shows that beauty demands for itself at least as much courage and decision as do truth and goodness, and she will not allow herself to be separated and banned from her two sisters without taking them along with herself in an act of mysterious vengeance. We can be sure that whoever sneers at her name as if she were the ornament of a bourgeois past, whether he admits it or not, can no longer pray and soon will no longer be able to love.
So one of the driving questions I put forth to myself and those I work with and live among is the question of what it means to be truly human, fully human. This question naturally falls into others that must be asked, and that is, what does it mean to be human? Are human beings in need of being more than they are? And by what standard are we using to measure our humanity? All of these are important to ask and answer, especially in this current climate of division and extremity. Because we have to ask ourselves these questions, it's just a natural state of human life in the current climate. Or perhaps there might be more to it, and how do we get there? My involvement with the arts for almost two decades and the communities I've participated in and sometimes help lead have looked for answers in the three transcendentals, the good, the true, and the beautiful, which are talked about in Balthasar's quote. It has been thought that in the pursuit of those three things together, we can find what true humanity looks like. And these three have been talked about and kicked around by philosophers for a long, long time, even back to the time of the Greek philosophers like Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. So this conversation is not new, And maybe because it is that important to our world and our communities, our own lives, that it has been around for so long. In the years I've been a part of this conversation about these three qualities, I've concluded that one important thing about them, regardless of where you think these three transcendentals are sourced or where they come from, that source of the good, the true, and beautiful has to be robust enough to carry all three. And that source needs, in my opinion, it needs to be both a transcendent and a personal source to really have all three of those be viable. Let me say it that way. And what do I mean by that? Well, wherever your source of the true, good, and beautiful comes from, it needs to be transcendent. It needs to be ultimate. It needs to be otherworldly. The reason it needs to be this is because those qualities need firm foundations in order to be credible, in order to be objective and immovable. So if your ultimate truth, goodness, and beauty doesn't have this quality, then there would be no place to land. There would be no place from which to make an accurate judgment about anything. And I would argue that this is actually impossible. Think of the simple statement that people can make for in our postmodern world as the only truth is there is no truth. You see how just in the nature of that simple statement, that is an ultimate truth, but there is no truth, and that's almost a nonsense statement. But you can see where it's impossible not to have your good source of truth, goodness, and beauty be an ultimate or transcendent source. When someone judges these things, it usually comes from a place of universal judgment. So your source needs to have that transcendental aspect. So your source needs to be transcendent, but it also needs to be personal. I think it needs to have cognizance.
What do you mean by transcendent? What's your definition of that? Because I've heard an awful lot, and I'm not tracking at all with what you're saying.
Ultimate, outside, not us. Outside the box of what we see, hear, smell, and taste. That's what I mean. It's got to be not sourced in us. And that would be even sourced in something that we can't necessarily always see, hear, touch, taste with our hands. So that's what I mean. It's outside our realm of being able to perceive. So that's what I mean by transcendent. And I know that's
so
very broad.
How do you talk to that about somebody who's not a church person? Because that's my crowd.
Well, I would ask them, have they ever made a moral judgment about someone else's action? If they have, isn't that making a judgment that's outside two people? If they make any kind of judgment about another group of people or another individuals, then that's a source of the good, the true, that's the source of the true, that's outside themselves. And that's how I would even dial it back that far if I'm going to talk to a non-churched person. That source, that kind of decision has to come from somewhere. And if it doesn't come from themselves, and it can't come from themselves, where does it come from? So that's where I would start.
So you would think that a moral decision is not from yourself?
It can be. But are you strong enough to actually bring that to bear on others? And that's where we are now, because then it becomes just mere power. If you gather enough people around you with you, then you can make the moral decisions for everybody. But if it's a moral decision that's outside yourself, transcendent, ultimate, then it's not in our control. It's made by someone else or something else. And I say it has to be someone else. So it has to be outside ourselves in order to have that grounding for the ultimate, in order for it to be applicable for at least more than just yourself. But I think it needs to be also personal and cognizant. It needs to be able to exercise a level of subjectivity. The transcendent means, to a degree, objective. It needs to be outside ourselves, but then the personal, it needs to have an exercise, an ability to be even in the subjective. The source of the true, good, and beautiful needs to have a sense of the rubber hits the road aspect to it. It needs to be applicable to everyday life, and if it doesn't have this characteristic, then all you have is the abstract, the impersonal and the ungraspable. So as a Christian, you can see that by this observation, my Judeo-Christian beliefs fulfill this characteristic. Judeo-Christian belief has always carried with it these two aspects. They describe the characteristics of God, Yahweh, and Jesus, either one. They are both transcendent and both personal. In Judaism, God was the unnamed God, but had a house in the middle of the city that was entered and attended to in daily work. So there was a transcendent God, there was an otherworldly God, but he was somebody that was close by. He was somebody that interacted with us. He's someone that we went and interacted with. And so we could apply what he says and how he interacted in the everyday life. It's the same for in Christianity. Jesus is both the man and the God. He claimed to be God and he was man. And this was evident in his rising from the dead and defeating death. So there's both the transcendent in that regard for the source of the good, true, and beautiful. But there's also the subjective. And so I wanted to talk about imagination here. How does imagination fit into that? With those two things, into the transcendentals of the true, good, and beautiful. How does it fit into the characteristics of transcendence and intimacy or personalness? And I believe a genuine pursuit of the transcendental make us better people. And when we are better people, our families are better, our communities are better, and our cities and societies will flourish. When we pursue and propagate real truth, we flourish. Not individual truths, not a group's or a society's truth, but the truth. When we pursue and propagate real goodness, the same happens, and the same also with beauty. When we pursue those genuinely, those three together, then I think we have a basis in which to see society flourish. Now, I want to argue tonight that a good amount of these issues that we are struggling with in our society are caused by the loss of beauty. That we drove it out, that we wandered away from beauty, and that we are reaping that consequence. And this is why I had Sarah read the Balthasar passage. We are reaping the mysterious vengeance of driving beauty away from her two sisters of truth and goodness. Now, it's important that all three of these transcendentals be addressed and applied together. Now, I think the mechanism of truth is reason. The way we work truth out is we use our reason. And yet, we seem to be living in a society that no longer cultivates a sense of the biblical adage, come let us reason together. I mean, there seems to be a lot of unreasonableness out there. Reason seems to have been lost to information and power. With the 24-hour news cycle and the information superhighway slipped like a wallet in our pockets or our bags, that has predominance on our lives, and it takes time away from thinking and reasoning, and that's why I think they've deteriorated. This is one of the reasons why, but I think information is replacing reason, and we're reaping that consequence. That could be the consequence of beauty being driven out. And I think goodness is followed. The mechanism of goodness, I'd say, is charity or selflessness. And there are some interesting examples of how this is going on in our culture. When I was looking at statistics about charitable giving in the last 50 years or so, and I was surprised to see that giving, the amount of money given, has actually gone up quite a bit in the last 50 years. So I thought maybe my point was lost. You know, it's like if the amount of money has been going up, then people are giving more. But if you really look a little deeper, you might find that that can be deceiving. The percentage of charitable giving for our entire gross domestic product, so everything that our nation has made monetarily, all the money we made as a country in a year, but all the charitable giving percentage of that was 2%. So 2% of everything the United States made in a year, only 2% was given to charitable giving. Okay? What's interesting is that percentage has been 2% for a long time. So, I actually found this on the philanthropyroundtable.org site. It said 2% of the GDP is a huge sum. But it's interesting that even as we became, as we have become a wealthier people in the post-World War II era, the fraction we give away hasn't risen in that same period of time. There seems to be something stubborn, they said, about that 2% rate. I thought that was an interesting line. So more money's being given, but that's because there are more people giving rather than people giving more. So that was an interesting little vignette that I found. Another possible sign of the idea is that goodness may be turning, that we may be turning in our culture, is the indication of the decline of happiness and the rise of young people taking pharmaceuticals to assist their happiness or their depression issues. I mean, we've seen this. We have some friends with some high school-aged kids, and you know, they and their friends are on these pharmaceuticals to deal with their depression. And we also see it in the growth of the self-help content that has happened over the last several decades. I think it was this last year, or 2017, maybe it was 2017, they said it was an $11 billion industry for self-help stuff. And I wonder if that's an indication of our turning in on ourselves rather than helping the other. Charity is about being selfless. And when we're turning in on ourselves, we're not exercising goodness. Now, for where I believe the source of the problems may be because of beauty, because we've driven beauty out. The reason that truth is being lost and reason deteriorating, the reason that goodness seems to be affected and our charity is paling, I would argue, is that it's because we long ago have, as Balthazar said, drove beauty out. And that mysterious vengeance seems to be our prophet. In his essay, The Wound of Beauty, Gregory Wolfe summarized Balthazar's meaning on this quote. He said this: "One of the more intriguing suggestions made by von Balthazar concerns that act of mysterious vengeance. When you remove beauty from the human equation, it is going to come back in some other form, even as anti-beauty. A good deal of modern art can be understood in this light. In modernity, beauty has been seen as an appearance, ornamentation, sugarcoating. Secularists and believers, he means Christians here, alike have either rejected beauty altogether or argued that beauty should make the pills of truth and goodness go down easier. Beauty must serve some other end, but never be an end to itself. But the transcendentals were always understood as infinitely valuable as an ends in themselves. When it comes to beauty, however, we are afraid to assert that much. We feel the need to harness it because beauty is unpredictable and wild." Now, I agree with Wolf here. We've lost beauty not only because we made it shallow, but we also were afraid to let it be what it was, which is, as he says, wild and unpredictable. Purposely so. Purposely wild and unpredictable. And it's for our betterment that it's wild and unpredictable. Truth and goodness are easier to grasp than beauty. Truth has logic. It has debate and discourse to assist. Goodness has acts of charity, you know, giving cups of water, food to the homeless, or raising money for jackets in the winter. And they have, so charity is there to address the need for helping your fellow human being. But beauty, there's a reason beauty calls it the disinterested one. And now you notice in that quote that from Balthazar, the only one of the sisters that seems to be moving is beauty. The other two are constellations. The double constellation, beauty seems to be moving around it. So I think the way we reinvigorate truth and its mechanism reason, the way we resurrect goodness and the mechanism of charity, is by pursuing beauty. And the mechanism of beauty, I think, is imagination. By cultivating imagination and creativity, we begin to get a handle on the elusive beauty. And this is why I'm presenting the passage in the Midsummer Night's Dream. It's incredibly informative as to the process of imagination. I'm going to read it again here so that we know. I'm going to read just Theseus's section here. It says, after Hippolyta's question, "Isn't this interesting?" he says, "More strange than true. I never may believe these antique fables, nor these fairy toys. Lovers and madmen have such seething brains, such shaping fantasies, that apprehend more than cool reason ever comprehends. The lunatic, the lover, and the poet are all of imagination, all compact. One sees more devils than vast hell can hold. That is the madman. The lover, all is frantic, sees Helen's beauty in a brow of Egypt. The poet's eye, in fine frenzy rolling, doth glance from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven, and as imagination bodies forth the forms of things unknown. The poet's pen turns them to shapes, and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. Such tricks have strong imagination, that if it would but apprehend some joy, to comprehend some bringer of that joy. Or in the night, imagining some fear, how easy a bush is supposed to bear. So, why is it important to understand the importance of cultivating imagination? Because it gives us insight on how that functions. By using the artist, or in this case the poet, as an example. So here Shakespeare is using Theseus, who's a skeptic, as a way of showing what the artist does. Philosophers are the acolytes of truth. They're the priests of truth. And I'd put scientists as a subset there. Priests, pastors, non-profit workers, and social workers are the priests or acolytes of goodness. But artists are the priests of beauty, and therefore the most adept at cultivating imagination. And again, as I said, we have this skeptic Theseus, and we see how through his scorn of the poet, he's actually making a rich and deep observation. He says, "The poet's eye, in fine frenzy rolling, looks from heaven to earth and earth to heaven, and as imagination bodies forth forms of things unknown, and turns to them to shapes and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name." So what imagination does is assist our minds with a level of embodiment of ideas and concepts. It gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. Imagination helps us to respect the unknown without giving up on knowing it. It helps us understand the mysterious without necessarily completely understanding the mysterious. Cultivating the imagination can both clarify and humble. It clarifies in that it helps give words and ideas to a hard subject to grasp, but it also humbles because at exactly the same time it shows how inadequate those words can be, making one and perhaps a group of persons approach the subject in the same manner, humbly. So you can see how this could assist us in our current state. What would happen to the severity of our words in debate about what's true and what's good? What would happen with the severity of our words in discourse if we were to work on our imaginations rather than our arguments? By cultivating imagination, we are inviting beauty to release her sisters from her act of vengeance and put them back into their proper orbit, to use Balthazar's image. And I think this is important to people who would term themselves as creative or non-creative. I think this is important for both creatives and non-creatives, artists and non-artists. So, how can you do this? How can you cultivate your imagination then? There are three things I'd like to suggest. First, look at where you already are engaging your imagination. Any books you're reading, perhaps fiction, movies or poetry. If you are, why not stimulate that further, perhaps expand it? Are there poetry readings in your town? Are you go with friends to go watch movies? Or perhaps you have a book club or a comic book club like I do. We read comic books and we discuss them on a monthly basis. Another thing you could do is intentionally place yourself in the orbit of an artist, befriend an artist. If artists are the priests of imagination, some of that might rub off on you and benefit you in how you look at stuff. Third, try your hand in visual arts in some form. Visual arts are another form of communication. They aren't simply visual images of literary words. They are actually a form of communication. Even C.S. Lewis had some thoughts about this in his essay, "Sometimes fairy stories are the best way to say what needs to be said." It's a great, did you get that? Sometimes fairy stories are the best way to say what needs to be said. Sometimes visually is the best way to say something that needs to be said. And by trying your hand at the visual, even if you stink at it, you will at least gain a better appreciation on how a visual communicator does that, and also have a better understanding of the content itself. And you'll be able to understand the skill and the form of communication even better. So in trying to place one of these in your daily or weekly arc of life will help you cultivate your imagination and perhaps begin to invite beauty back, perhaps bringing truth and goodness with her. So I want to close, and then we'll take a short break with those words from Gregory Wolfe's essay on the wound of beauty. It's an essay that I think is an incredible primer for this content. I've only said a few meager words that I think Greg can say even better, even in this essay. I go back to this essay often and read it again and again. It's a sign of a very good, thoughtful essay. And it's this quote is basically a call for action by Greg. He says, "The time has come to bring beauty back, to give it the glass slipper and invite it to the prom. The thinker who has helped me most along these lines is the 20th century theologian Hans Urs von Balthasar. His argument, and it is a rather unsettling one, is that of the three transcendentals, beauty is the one that is least troubled by our fallen condition. In a world plagued by sin and error, he says, truth and goodness are always hotly contested. How do you live righteously? What is the truth? As we debate these matters, we have axes to grind. But beauty, von Balthasar says, is disinterested. It has no agenda. Beauty can sail under the radar of our anxious contention over what is true and what is good, carrying along its beam a ray of beatific vision. Beauty can pierce the heart, wounding us with the transcendent glory of God."